This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The story starts in a classroom at Duke. Rachel Seidman was teaching a course called Women in the Public Sphere. She told her class to come up with a group project as their final assignment. The students decided to ask their peers why they needed feminism. They'd take pictures of the students holding up a whiteboard with statements that started with, "I need feminism because." For instance, "I need feminism because people still think it's okay to joke about rape. It's not." Or, "I need feminism because I'm tired of boys thinking the worst thing they could ever be compared to is a girl." Or, "I need feminism because my body is beautiful just the way it is." Well, they started printing these pictures as posters and hanging them around campus, and then they created a Facebook page and a Tumblr blog. Their project went viral. After a month, they had more than 11,000 likes on Facebook. Their Tumblr received more than 80,000 visits from 144 countries, and that was something neither the students nor their teacher expected. Joining me now are two of the students behind the project, Ashley Tsai and Catherine Kapoff, and their instructor, Rachel Seidman, who's an adjunct professor at Duke and an associate professor in the director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We are taking your calls and emails, too, 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. Why do you need feminism? That's the question today, 877-962-9862. So let me start with you, Rachel. Tell me about the assignment. How did this project start?
Well, my parameters for this assignment were that the students had to work as a group. They had to work as a class and to come up with an idea for something that they were concerned about, they were passionate about, that they wanted to make some difference on. And it had to relate to the class, which, as you said, was Women in the Public Sphere, History, Theory, and Practice. So they had been learning about the history of women's activism over the last couple of centuries and about current debates, issues, and theories about women in leadership and today. So they had to work together. They had to care enough about what they were going to choose that they would follow through with it even after the class ended. So I told them at the beginning, this has to be something you care enough about that you will continue on with it. Because in the past, some of the other projects my students have done have required follow through after the class gets over with. So I told them all of those things, but really beyond that, it was up to them what they wanted to do. And I tried to kind of lay the groundwork over the whole semester. Every week at the beginning of class, I would ask them to share things that they had read about in the newspaper or to discuss things that were happening on class so that over the course of the semester, they started making connections between what they were learning about in history and what they were seeing going on around them on campus or in the world outside of campus to really get them thinking about these issues and how they related to them. I sort of asked them to keep a clippings file about things that struck their interest or made them upset. So they had kind of built over the course of the semester a habit of talking together about these issues. I worked very hard on building a sense of trust among them so that they knew that this was a cohort that they could work together with. And I used the writing assignments over the course of the semester as a way to get them starting to think actively and to find their voice. So, for instance, one of the papers in the class had to be written as an op-ed. And in fact, they would get extra credit if they actually got it published somewhere. So I sort of laid this groundwork of getting them to think together about these issues, building a sense of trust among each other and using their voice out in the world. But the rest of it was up to them.
Rest of it was up to them. Ashley, how did you then, on that foundation, decide on the topic, who needs feminism?
Well, it certainly was something we did as a class together throughout the semester as we were talking about the things that we were interested in, the things that made us upset or angry. We started to see that there were definitely shared experiences among the women in the class. And one of them, as we were reading more and more feminist theory and about feminist activism, we all kind of started to think about how feminism was talked about in our lives and among our friends and peers. And it was generally a very negative thing. Feminism was not something that was talked about in a positive light. Most of the time, the most common phrase was, well, I'm not a feminist, but, and someone would proceed to say something that was a feminist. So we kind of, so we thought about why we felt that feminism was important, and we just decided that this was something that we felt was necessary, that we needed to deconstruct these negative connotations with feminism, because there were obviously still many, many problems that remained, and that feminism still could address, and we wanted to show that feminism was relevant in our lives today, even as young women.
Well, it's interesting that you chose that question, who needs feminism, and not what is feminism, if the problem is these misconceptions about feminism. Did you talk about that, and why was what is feminism not chosen? Catherine?
Well, I think that, you know, we did obviously discuss the idea of addressing this campaign with the sentence, feminism is, and fill in the blank. But we, you know, as we discussed it, we realized that we didn't want to get into the business of defining feminism. We felt like, you know, throughout our studies, the definition of feminism has been debated so much, and people have been criticized for having one definition of feminism or another. And I guess another main concern of ours was that we didn't want to eliminate people from this campaign. We didn't want anyone to feel like they couldn't relate to it. And so somebody brought up the idea of the question, who needs feminism? And we felt like, you know, we didn't have to define feminism. We didn't have to define this word that people have debated for centuries. But we also felt like it was a less threatening way to approach it, and it was a less threatening way to approach other people. It was a way that we could ask males, we could ask females, we could ask people from different racial backgrounds, from different social backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds, all of those things. And the question, who needs feminism, could still be answered by a variety of people.
Well, and I want to get a sense from Ashley now what the project was then. So initially, this was conceived as something you would do on campus, right? To tell us what right. The initial project looked like, or how you outlined it.
The initial project was that we would photograph a few people on campus, and we would put up these posters around campus. And poster campaigns have been pretty popular around campus, so it's not like we were necessarily putting out a whole new idea. But so we put up these posters, and as we were asking people to come sign up to be photographed and to have their own statements, it was just kind of an overwhelming amount of responses. I had no idea that we would have more than 60 people come forward and say that they wanted to be photographed. And even after we were finished photographing, many people were upset that they hadn't gotten the chance to be photographed. Even just in the initial phases, we were kind of starting to see that this was touching the lives of many others that we didn't expect. And we had planned on having a Facebook group, and we talked about having a Tumblr as well. That we just didn't think it was that big of a deal when we made a Facebook group. We didn't expect it to get over 1,000 likes on the first day, and we just never expected it to get so big.
Well, Catherine, as it got bigger and bigger, what surprised you most about that? And not only in terms of the numbers, I guess you were surprised as well, right?
Definitely,
with the number of responses and how quickly they were coming in, and from all over the world, obviously available, because you're on the web. But the fact is, what about the responses themselves? Were any of them surprising to you?
I think that the thing that was most surprising to me was the negative response that we got. I think going into the project, a lot of us said that we expected some people to disagree with what we were doing, but I don't think we expected, we didn't expect our posters to be defaced. We didn't expect to find posters on the ground with, footprints on them. So I think that that's what really shocked me the most, is how outspoken people were about disagreeing with what we were saying.
Well, it's interesting because it's just people saying they need feminism because. So what kind of negative responses were you getting?
So I know on one of the posters that we posted on campus, they I guess took a white piece of paper and posted it on top of where the whiteboard was in the picture and said, I need feminism because, you know, and I can't remember the exact wording. It was something about
sandwiches won't make themselves.
Right, because sandwiches won't make themselves.
There you go.
Or, and another one was very similar, talking about it being funny when women try to play sports.
Well, let me ask Rachel Seidman if you were surprised at the response to this.
Well, I was and I wasn't. So one of the conversations we had, one of the books we read or an excerpt of the book we read was Susan Faludi's Backlash. And I talked to the students about the issue of backlash and how this happens routinely over time. And I remember having a sort of pep talk with them about, you know, you're going to need to have each other's backs, that there is going to be backlash. You need to be prepared for that. And you need to support each other through it because it may be painful. So I wasn't surprised in that way, but I was nevertheless shocked by some. I mean, the ones that Catherine has reported were the relatively inane and silly ones, but there were others that really approached hate speech, true misogynistic, horrors.
We will continue our conversation. Who needs feminism? The question to you, 877-962-9862. When our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We've been talking with Ashley Tsai and Catherine Kapoff. They're students at Duke, part of a project on campus called Who Needs Feminism? For the project, they asked fellow Duke students to complete the sentence, I need feminism because, and to write their answers on a small whiteboard. Photographs of the people holding the board with their answers were blown up into posters, hung around campus, and then there's a Facebook page and a Tumblr blog as well. Ashley and Catherine's professor, Rachel Seidman, is here as well. She's an adjunct professor at Duke and associate director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Joining us now is Ranjana Khanna. She is the director of the Women's Studies Department at Duke University. And Lisa Levenstein is also with us. She's an associate professor of history at UNC Greensboro. Welcome to both of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Taking phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. Why do you need feminism? So, Ashley, with this project, were you trying to reclaim the word feminism?
Yeah, in a sense, we were, because so much of the general sentiment on campus was that it wasn't necessary, and you can see that from the backlash that we got. Why were people so upset by the fact that we were saying we still needed it? And it's people were upset that we were saying that the problems were still existing and that we still needed change and that we weren't finished. And so, yes, we were trying to reclaim the word feminism, and especially as young feminists, we wanted to say that we recognize these issues as well, that we were aware and that we felt that the movement still needed to continue.
I want to talk to the people around the table who teach this this subject and ask if they feel the same thing. Ranjana, let me start with you. Do you find your students shy away from this term? They try not to identify with it?
Well, it depends on which students, of course. Many of the students in women's studies do not shy away from it at all and embrace it, even though they understand it to be a term with much variation within it. Obviously, it means many things, and I appreciate the point about not wanting to have to define feminism. Part of its virtue, perhaps, and its potential weakness is its capaciousness as a category. But yes, certainly, I think that there has been, when I look at students generally around campus, not only on Duke's campus, of course, but elsewhere I've taught too, there is some doubt, fear, antipathy towards the term feminism. And one of the things that I try to do in my courses is to make it a term that that is not that, and to explain when I was at university, it was actually a term that designated some of the cool kids, as it were. You know, it wasn't a nerdy term. It wasn't a term that was a source of contempt, even though it may have been threatening at times to people's ways of life and modes of thought.
Well, Lisa Levenstein, this whole question of "I'm not a feminist, but," I mean, is that something you encounter in among your students, the sense that they, by the end of the class, you know, sort of present themselves as feminists, though they refuse to define themselves that way?
In my classes, which are women's history classes, I try to really look at the history of what feminism actually was, which is something that I feel students are afraid of the term, but they don't even really know what that movement is that they're rejecting. And so one of the things that we do is we look at really the breadth of feminism and, you know, dating back to the 19th century, but particularly I think the period that really captures students' attention is the 1970s. And we look at the breadth of feminism and the kind of breadth of issues that were embraced by feminists, but also something very important teaching at a public institution such as UNCG is we look at the breadth of women who were involved in the movement. And I think there's a real sense in terms of that feminism is somehow a white middle class thing. And one of the things that we talk about a lot in my class is the long history of diverse women, women of color, poor women, working class women who were involved in various feminist campaigns over time. And I think that's a really important history to reclaim in terms of people, a wide range of women today, being able to see that they have a history in this movement that is connected to this movement.
Where's the misperception? Where did this come from, the sense that feminism is a white middle class movement?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not, that's just one of the many myths about feminism that are out there that have a long history. Because as Rachel was saying earlier, you know, kind of for as long as we've had feminism, we've had anti-feminism, right? The two kind of go together, and they have throughout our history. And, I mean, there's two. One thing is the media and the media portrayals of feminism, which often, you know, focus on white middle class women spokespeople. But there's also been growing up alongside of feminism, a real conservative campaign to redefine feminism and to create myths about feminism. For example, the idea that feminists are man-haters, the idea that feminists are anti-family. All of these kinds of ideas have a history, and they also originated in the 1970s and came and grew kind of hand-in-hand with the feminist movement.
Let's go to the phones now. Jesse is on the line from Durham. Hello, Jesse.
Hi. Thank you very much for the show today. It's a great topic. I'm calling because I feel like as a man who identifies as a feminist, whenever I sort of bring that up, I feel kind of alone. I get strange looks from both the men who I'm friends with and many of the women who don't really know how to perceive me as a feminist.
All right, Jesse, let's get a response. Thank you.
Jesse, I think one of the most inspiring things about this campaign to me has been the role that men have played in it. The students in their original poster campaign were surprised and very pleased by the number of young men who came forward and were willing to have their pictures taken with their statements, as well as people of color who participated in the campaign. And I think that I hope that you and other young men out there can use the Tumblr and the posters as a way to find a sense of community, that you're not alone, and certainly to recognize that the young women in the campaign and the others of us around the table recognize the importance of male allies, and that you have a really crucial role to play.
Ashley, what did you, and I'm going to ask Catherine the same thing in a second, what did you learn about the role of men in feminism, or the way sort of males approach feminism from this campaign? Did you learn, was there anything that sort of that you took away from the campaign when you saw the responses from men?
Do you mean both positive and negative?
Yeah.
Well, I learned a lot. I think I think Professor Seidman mentioned that the word feminism does feel threatening in a lot of ways to men because I guess I don't really know how to explain it. Well, the negative responses I got from men, a lot of them tended to be that they didn't understand why women were still so upset. That look at all the women at Duke, and look at all the women in leadership positions at Duke, and look at all the women who are graduating in higher numbers than men now from schools and are so successful. And they didn't understand why we still felt that there were issues. But then you just, I don't know, you look at the statistics, such as 1 in 4 women will be sexually assaulted in their time in college. And the fact that that's not, that doesn't raise right. eyebrows, that's not alarming, that's just an accepted fact, is very scary. And most people know that statistics, and it's not, it's just a fact.
Let me ask Catherine the same question, because I think you're pointing to something very interesting here in your answer, and that is the fact that men in some ways do feel threatened, and ask this question, look, why do we need this? It's been accomplished. Women now have access to all of the same things that they didn't in the 70s and the late 60s. So what's the point? What was your idea about that question going in, and what did you think about the response of men in your campaign?
I think that you can look at a lot of statistics and say that, you know, or argue that women have achieved equality. But if you talk to women individually and ask about their personal experiences, you get a very different response. And, you know, I think that that's something that the Tumblr has really brought out, and that women feel that they feel that they are not receiving the same levels of respect. There are statistics that, again, back inequality, you know, things like the fact that about 80% of African-American women who go into the law, you know, go into the field of practicing law, leave within 5 years. And, so there may be equal numbers of women entering the workforce, but
something's
they're not staying
on.
There.
Right. Lisa Levenstein?
Yeah, I think this is another example of what happens when we misperceive what feminism actually was about and is about today. So when you look at many of the core issues from 1970s feminism and you think about whether or not they've been accomplished today, you see that, in fact, you know, it is feminism's project is very unfinished, and in some ways we are going backwards. So think about, for example, you know, core feminist issues from the 70s, universal, accessible, affordable childcare. Think about things about the gender segmentation of the labor force, the fact that there's some jobs done particularly by women, some done particularly by men. Think about things about the media and representations of women in the media and the sexualization of women in the media. Think about all of the issues surrounding women's bodies, whether that's rape, domestic violence, and of course now reproductive rights and contraception, abortion, all of those issues on which, you know, we're increasingly, you know, are threatened, and we've been gone backwards in the past decades. When you understand the capacious agenda that feminism had and still has, and you don't just think about it as being, you know, issues about whether or not there are equal numbers of doctors, but you understand the breadth of feminism, then you also understand the work that still is left to be done.
Ranjana, does that breadth, that capaciousness, include issues that are broadly applicable and benefit, you know, men as well as women when you apply a critique to a social and an economic system that does oppress women in particular ways?
Yes, I think so. I think that when you look at feminism as a critical apparatus that is related to social movement issues but also distinct from them, you can see the different kinds of ways in which the historically, geographically, and philosophically questions that are relevant to men and women and different forms of gendering are addressed in feminism today as yesterday. I think that some of the questions that most obviously affect women today when you're talking about social movements, questions of equal pay, questions of sexual violence, questions of contraception, abortion rights, marriage. These are questions that affect men and women in different ways, right? What it means now to be constituted as a man and what it means to be constituted as a woman is also something that is in variation historically and contemporaneously.
Well, and it's one thing to look at the particular effects on women, which are particular and they're different from the way they affect men. But then if you look at the structure from which these spring, you find out that a lot of people are affected by this and not in good ways. And so the critique itself, can it be applied to if the changes, if those advances had continued on that trajectory that we began in the 70s and hadn't gone backwards, would we all be better off today? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's the question. Wouldn't feminism have lifted a lot of us out of some of what we're enduring today?
I would say that's absolutely incontrovertible.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And I think one of the things that's interesting, even about the backlash posts from the men, often young men, is that sometimes if you can kind of suppress your rage at what they're saying, what you see underneath is a lot of pain and a lot of, almost a kind of cry for I don't know how to be a man anymore. The economy is falling apart, the gender roles are changing. I don't know what it means to be a man, and therefore I'm going to lash out and make sure you stay in your place so that I know what my place is. And you can kind of see a level of pain there.
There was one Tumblr entry in particular that talked about a young woman who said her father, they're eating dinner, and he said, I never had high expectations for you or your sister, not as much as your brother. It's because you were girls. And she was wounded, and she expressed that, and I think the line is, and so he took another bite of chicken. I look at that man and say, this is a man who's deeply bruised and wounded. Mm-hmm. I mean, what he did was wrong. Obviously, the expectations are misguided. But here's a guy exactly who doesn't know how to be a man and doesn't know his place anymore and can't even express his pain at what he's just caused. Mm-hmm. Doesn't even know how to show his daughter how much that hurt him. Had to, And so that's, I think, a little bit of what's going on under the surface. Also, people are privileged by the same system that can hurt them. So it's not just that you're being, bruised by this system, but also your privilege. Want to hang on to that. 877-962-9862. We have Thomas on the line. Hello, Thomas.
Hello. I am a Duke alumnus and identify, like your first caller, as a male who describes himself as a feminist. So hope your first caller no longer finds himself alone. I wanted to offer my definition that I use for feminism, which is essentially someone who upholds a belief of equality between men and women. And I would want to add also that I am a dating woman who's several years younger than I am, and sometimes find it surprising when I'm more willing to embrace the term feminism than she is, and I can't help but wonder if that doesn't owe to some of the negative stereotypes that have been perhaps receiving more public voice in recent years than the more traditional proponent voices of feminism enjoyed in decades past.
All right, Thomas, thanks. Anybody want to take that one?
Sure. I think that the question of the issue of the negative campaign against feminism is a really important one. And in fact, I think that to some extent, the usefulness of the project, the class project, is partly that it gives a different kind of life to feminism. You know, in some ways, it's an advertising campaign. You know, one could think of it like that. In some ways, it's a different kind of use of various forms of technology, and one could say that most political movements, and feminism as at least one level a political movement, have used technology historically in various ways. And so what one of the things that's been very interesting about this project is the occupation, if you like, of a number of different kinds of technology, from speech to handwriting to photography to the internet to Facebook to the blog, and to reimagine them in different sorts of ways and with different functions. So I do think that there has been this barrage of publicity in a number of different forums against feminism, and I can see that this sort of affects different age groups differently.
Mm-hmm. I think this is seemed to me that the project emerged out of this real sense of frustration on the students' part that there were important things going on campus, sexual assault, other things that they really cared about, and they couldn't even have those conversations with their peers because of the sort of instantly, you know, you're just a feminist and I don't want to talk about that kind of stuff. And so they needed to do this to open up that space.
We will continue this conversation this hour. Who needs feminism? 877-962-9862. You can answer the question with your call, and you can check out the Tumblr and see what some of the responses have been. Whoneedsfeminism.tumblr.com is where to go, and you can stay right here as our conversation on the state of things continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour about the current generation of college-age feminists, show prompted by Who Needs Feminism, a project at Duke University. Ashley Tsai and Catherine Kapoff are here, undergraduates at Duke, who helped create the Who Needs Feminism project. Their professor, Rachel Seidman, is here. Ranjana Khanna is also with us. She's the director of Women's Studies Department at Duke. Lisa Levenstein is an associate professor of history at UNC Greensboro. And we're taking your calls, 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org. Why do you need feminism? Let's talk a little bit more about this, the power of social media and how this works. Catherine, you did take it to the streets. It wasn't as though you didn't have, you know, human contact in this, but ultimately the project is a virtual one. How does that turn into, do you mean to turn this into a kind of social action project? Is action one of the outcomes that you'd hope for?
I don't think it was our original goal, and I think that's a question that as a class and individually we're still debating. Our individual goal or our original goal was to destigmatize the word feminism and to make feminism something that more people, specifically on our campus, we wanted more people to feel comfortable identifying with feminism so that these necessary conversations could take place. You know, obviously, we've gotten a lot more attention than we expected, and we're still trying to figure out where we want to go with that, or if we want to do something with that, or if we want this social media campaign to speak for itself. It has encouraged conversation, and that's still a big question.
Well, let me ask Ashley how she feels about that. Ashley?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it really depends on how you define action, because I think conversation is action. And I think conversation can be a really, really powerful tool for changing the way that people think and for challenging the way that people think. And so I do think that the goal, in a sense, was action, and that action was to begin talking about feminism and talking about the things that feminism addresses, and just simply because those conversations were not happening at all and that they were actually stigmatized when they were happening. And I think that the reason why the internet and social media worked so well for this campaign was that it gave people an avenue for saying what they really think. And that works both ways. It works for the people who've been wanting to speak out about any injustices they've felt for a long time and haven't had a way to talk about it. But it also works for people who who are anti-feminist, and one of the things that people tend to say is bad about the internet is that people don't have to be accountable for what they say, and they can hide behind their computers. But it's actually very interesting to look at what people say when they they don't have to be held accountable, and they have free reign to say what they want, and to really see what people actually are thinking, and that 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 kind of uncovers a lot of the things that political correctness tends to cover up.
Lisa Levenstein?
I think what we're seeing in the early 20th century is a real redefinition of what activism is, and that I would totally agree. And I would take it further for an example of this. Really, we saw with the whole issue around the funding for Planned Parenthood with the Susan Komen Foundation, the breast cancer organization that pulled its funding from Planned Parenthood because of encouragement from anti-abortion, some of its anti-abortion supporters. Well, what happened was a tremendous social media campaign where Planned Parenthood, you know, announced this over Facebook, and there were blogs, there were Twitters. I mean, and it went viral. And because of that talk, that social that all happened over the internet, because of that, Komen reversed its decision. So, I mean, that's a perfect example of the way that social media is really redefining what action is.
I'd like to go to the phones now. Carter is on the line from Durham. Hello, Carter.
Yes.
Do you have an observation or a question for us?
Yeah, I just had kind of a personal story about, you know, my own, I guess, like calling to feminism. I'm transgender, female to male, and growing up, I had a lot of friends that, you know, got really into feminism, and I remember just thinking, oh, well, you're just looking for something to be angry about, you know, we're not treated any differently, you know, we get treated just the same as men do, and it actually took me making the decision at 25 to, you know, transition into a male to notice, and it was, you know, just a slap in the face that my initial, you know, first few months passing as male, I looked, you know, about 14 years old, and I got more respect immediately as a 14-year-old looking boy than I ever got as a grown woman. And from that day forward, I was like, all right, you know, this is real, you know, and I try to just let people know that experiencing it from both sides that, you know, it is a real thing. The respect levels are different.
How did you experience that? How did you have that sense that you were getting more respect?
Just not having to, not ever having to prove anything, just off the bat, not being pandered to, not, you know, like, you know, being in the South to a lot of like the, you know, the sweethearts, honeys, you know, which I had grown so used to, and I guess I before I wasn't really noticing the ways that I was being allowed to I guess fall back onto you know, a little bit of not weakness, but that it was okay to let someone else do something, and it was kind of expected to not be aggressive. I had always gotten a lot of pushback from men in the workplace with being an aggressive female. I had a lot of problems with coworkers and superiors.
Yeah.
And that was just all immediately gone.
Wow.
Every personality trait that I felt was standing in my way or was getting me judged was suddenly a positive personality
trait. Suddenly it's an asset. Wow. Carter, thank you so much for your call. 877-962-9862 is the number to call. Well, let me ask you, Catherine, about what you came into this project with, your understanding of feminism, what, if anything, it had done for you as a young woman up until that time, and your understanding of what it may have done for you now that you didn't know.
Well, I definitely identified as a feminist before this project, mainly because I'm surrounded with women in my life who are comfortable identifying as feminists, and I've done work with domestic violence victims. So in that sense, I very much have seen the need for feminism. But, you know, I think the caller brought up some I sympathize with a lot of what he just said, and that, you know, my entire life I have had to work harder. And I think that that's changed somewhat at this point, because it's easy for me to tell, you know, a grown man that I attend Duke, and all of a sudden their demeanor changes and their level of respect for me changes, and they will speak to me in a different way. And I was very aware of that before going into this project.
Well, how about you, Ashley?
Yeah, I mean, I also did identify as a feminist before the project, but it was sort of a long time coming. I really had no idea what feminism was until I came to Duke. And it wasn't until I took my first women's studies class, and then I went on a retreat called Common Ground, where we talked about issues of gender and sexuality and race. And then I began to meet people who were aware and could describe their own experiences of discrimination, that I started to realize my own experiences of discrimination. And I sort of started realizing all these things when I, as a freshman, my dream job had been to be a photographer and to travel the world and be on my own. And my first summer working as a documentary photographer kind of changed that. I realized that there were places I couldn't go by myself, people I couldn't talk to by myself, people who wouldn't respect me because I was a woman, who would treat me differently. And all that kind of started to come together. And then my eyes were just opened to the ways that I was limited, because I've been taught all my life that I could do whatever I wanted. And yeah, so it was all of that realization kind of pushed me and made me realize that feminism was something that I needed and that was relevant to me and to a lot of the other women around me.
And that's part of the value of this conversation, isn't it? That what we internalize, what we make accommodations to and normalize, because it's with us every single day, is what you call attention to in a project like this, and then force a reaction. Not all of them good, but force some kind of a reaction. And what about that? This notion of just simply internalizing and accommodating, making accommodation with the role that you're given, because it's just too hard to fight.
Well, I think that there are there's certainly accommodation to different roles, and as a result of it just being too difficult to fight something, or just easier to carry on and without a fight, which I think is part of it. But I also think that there's an accommodation to the ideas of feminism without an embrace of the term, which is sort of the flip side of this. Sometimes I wonder in the rejection of feminism whether there's a rejection of a social movement or a rejection of a term. It seems to me that many people who do not identify as feminists, to use the term that both the student participants have used, identify as, many don't identify as a feminist, but absolutely believe in the justice projects that are associated with feminism and have been part of the work of feminism. So many people believe that the sexual division of labor is a problem. Many people believe that there should be access to good nutrition for men and women alike, that there shouldn't be so much sexual violence, that there should be equal pay. And these battles are battles that need to be continue to need to be fought. So I think that there is oftentimes an absorption of various roles and various positions on both sides of the matter here. To some extent, one could say, well, in that case, do we really need a term like feminism anymore? And I would say, yes, we do, because there's still a project that needs to be identified as such. And there's no reason why the term should be so threatening, even though one would presumably want to say that historically there have been good things and some negative things that have been done in the history of feminism. It's been associated with different kinds of colonial movements at different times historically. It's sometimes been associated with racist movements as well, and that is a part of feminism's history as much as the forms of progress, if one wants to use that term, that we associate with it. So I do think that there needs to be distinctions around the rejection of the term, why it's been rejected at different points historically, why I think today it needs to be embraced for its capaciousness, mm-hmm. for the understanding of feminism as a justice project that has in more recent years been associated with anti-colonial moves, anti-racism, with different kinds of attitudes towards sexuality than there have been historically.
Well, Rachel, I wonder if you think, is it a marketing problem? Would changing the name make a difference, or are these ideas so threatening that whatever you call them, there would be a kind of backlash?
Well, I think that it is actually really important because to me, the idea, the sort of I'm not a feminist but statement reveals two things. One is what Lisa was saying, a lack of understanding of what feminism has been and is. It's a kind of lack of understanding about history because what they have in mind is a caricature of a feminist, and that's what they think they're not. But it also is a lack of understanding about what it takes to make political change, social change. I mean, it's fine to say, well, I believe that, you know, we need equality between the sexes, but how are you going to get there if you can't identify a group of people with whom you will work toward that? And so we need labels, we need names, we need ways of cohering together, we need movements. And if you reject identifying with other people who think this way, then you're not going to get very far.
What do you think, Lisa?
Yeah, I totally agree with Rachel on that. And I think that one of the really wonderfully heartening things along with this project at Duke is the way that young women today are reclaiming this term and defining it in a whole host of ways, often on the internet, on various blogs and websites and the other kinds of things I'm sure I don't even know about, but that there's a wonderfully diverse, engaged group of young women who are defining feminism in an incredibly broad and exciting way that itself has a long history that really it takes on, you know, issues that are not just maybe you would not just think is traditional women's issues. So, I mean, for sure, they're interested in things like childcare or abortion rights or rape or domestic violence. But also, you know, these are feminists who believe that the struggle over immigration is a feminist issue. Mm-hmm. These are feminists who think that things that have to do with our environment are feminist issues, that the killing of Trayvon Martin, that is a feminist issue. Mm-hmm. So all of these, this really broad, exciting definition of feminism and real engagement with the issues at hand that are going on today and a real call to action about those issues in the way that these women of this generation see fit.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Ashley Tsai and Catherine Kapoff are undergrads at Duke. Rachel Seidman, an associate director of the Southern Oral History Program. Ranjana Khanna is the director of Women's Studies Department at Duke University. Lisa Levenstein, an associate professor of history at UNCG. Thank you for listening, and thank all of you for being on the show. Great to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.
And thank you for listening. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. And our producers are Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Dixon Cruz, our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.